All right, Steve Lamb, alcoholic.
Steve.
Last session before lunch, because God knows they don't feed us enough up here. Yeah. Okay, we're going to talk about forgiveness and amends. And the reason why I bring up forgiveness for your consideration, because it seems to me, my experience is that the only true and complete remedy for a resentment is forgiveness. I mean, we talk in AA a lot about acceptance. But I can accept you and still resent you. If I've forgiven you, I no longer resent me. And resentment is the number one offender. So what happens is, at least from my experience, I have a desire that you behave a certain way or don't behave a certain way, or that I get something or that I don't have to give up something. And then I come into contact with you and you conflict with my perceived sense of desire of what I want. And I don't get what I want. And that causes conflict, and as a result of that conflict, I develop a resentment. Now, if it's a minor resentment, you know, you cut in front of me in front of traffic, okay, I'm human, I can forgive that. But if it's a big resentment, like the resentment I talked about against my father, even though it's misguided, even though it doesn't make sense, even though it's been pointed out to me that I'm no better than my father, of myself, I cannot forgive. I can't. I need divine intervention. I need spiritual help. It's not something I can do of myself. So I'm gonna read you some quotes from some various different sources regarding forgiveness, and I just want you to think about them in the context of your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. In the Bible, at John 20:23, if you forgive others their sins, they are indeed forgiven. If you withhold forgiveness from one another, they are held bound. So our forgiveness is dependent on our ability to forgive. Rumi says, ego does not forgive. It stands and shouts coarse commands. Grace comes in to forgive and then forgive again. In the Tao Te Ching, it is said, being one with the Tao, when you seek, you find. And when you make a mistake, you are forgiven. That is why everybody loves it, which makes a lot of sense. In the Quran, it says, but forgive and overlook until Allah brings his command. Truly, Allah is able to do all things. Marcus Aurelius in Meditations, he's talking about his father. And his father is the person that he wants to become. And he's talking about his father and he says, his manner was never to wonder at anything, never to be in haste, and yet never slow, nor to be perplexed or dejected, or at any time unseemly, or excessively to laugh, nor to be angry or suspicious, but ever ready to do good and to forgive and to speak truth. In Anamkara, written by a guy named John O'Donohue, was a former Catholic priest. And Anamkara in Celtic means soul friend. He says, may you be able to journey to that place in your soul where there is great love, warmth, feeling, and forgiveness. May this change you. May it transfigure that which is negative, distant, or cold in you. And this is the process of the steps, so that we get through forgiveness in this amends process and we're transformed. We have this psychic change that the doctor talks about. Alexander Pope said, to err is human, to forgive is divine. That's what I was talking about when I said, if you cut me off in traffic, it's one thing. If it's my father, it's another thing. Mother Teresa says, we cannot forgive unless we know that we need forgiveness. And forgiveness is the beginning of love. You know, we've all heard the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against him. And later on in Matthew, Peter had come up to Jesus and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Until seven times? And the carpenter said to him, I don't tell you until seven times, but until 70 times seven. Why? Because resentment is the number one offender. It blocks us off from God. It blocks us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. One of the last things that the carpenter said, supposedly, when he died on the cross was, for God, Father, forgive them. they know not what they do. And one of the things that was helpful to me was to understand and appreciate that everything is not personal. Everything is not personal. So when you slight me or you do something that offends me, that could be simply that you're having a bad day and I happen to be in your bursting radius. Now, I know this from doing inventory and realizing that I've harmed a lot of people, that it wasn't personal. They just walked into my circumference of fire and it was a bad day for them. Okay? It's not personal. And that's one of the things that I think is really, really critical to try to appreciate. And it's just, you know, it's not easy. Because when you're new, it seems like they're doing it to me. When in reality, it's just happening to me. And sometimes when we talk about it's real or imagined, it's not even happening to me. I think it's happening, but it's not happening. One of the biggest resentments that I had against my wife, which seemed huge, it's going to seem ridiculous because it is, but it seemed huge to me, was that I'd made amends to her. Things were going relatively well, but she would take the trash and recycling and put it on the stoop at night. Now, I'm not stupid. I know what that means. I'm not restored to full husband status. I'm really just the trash guy. I got to take out the trash and recycle. I'm pissed. And I'm not stupid. I take it out. I put it in the trash bin. I take it in the recycling bin. But I'm writing inventory. I go to Michael. I read this inventory to Michael. Can you believe what she's doing? Apparently, I'm just the trash and recycling guy. He says, have you talked to her? I'm like, well, no, I haven't talked to her. No, I haven't talked to her. He said, well, you know, this could be a real or imagined thing. I said, you know, Michael, I know what you're thinking, but at the time I've been married 12, 13, 14 years, and I told him, I said, Michael, I know what she's thinking before she's thinking it. And he says to me, well, you know, we call that mind reading, Lamb, and it's a relatively serious character defect. But if you're not willing to, you know, look at that yourself, you're going to have to pray and meditate, you know, and ask for guidance and direction, you know, because this is a resentment. It's a number one offender. So I get quiet, I'm praying and meditating, I'm asked for guidance and direction. It takes several months, you know. And what comes to me is patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. It's what we talk about. It's all over the big book. It's what everybody says, but I can't hear it until I hear it. It's like, you ever go to a meeting, you've been working with some guy for, you know, 6 months, trying to get it, whatever, write inventory, make amends, pray, meditate. And then some chucklehead gives a talk. And then afterwards at coffee, the guy looks at you and goes, hey man, did you hear Jerry? I think I'm going to try that. And you're like, God, I've been talking to you about that for 6 months. But you just don't hear it, right? You just don't hear it until you hear it. So I pray for patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. I got it. You know, I got the trash recycling. I'm a man of God. I'm sponsoring guys. And by the way, I got to tell all the guys what great work I've done on this amends, that I have worked through this. Again, the spiritual pride thing. You know, this doesn't go on long, only about 7 or 8 years. And then we get a dog, Zoe. Zoe's a golden retriever. She does what she does. She eats, she poops. I take her out in the morning, she poops. I put it in a bag, I put it in the trash can, right? On nights that I go to meetings, my wife will let her in the backyard. Zoe will poop. And, you know, my wife will pick it up. She'll put it in a bag, but does she put it in the trash can? No. She puts it with the trash and recycling on the stoop. So, I mean, I'm spiritual. I've worked through the trash recycling, but now I got dog crap. I got dog crap, Michael. I'm writing inventory. I got dog crap. I know what dog crap means. And you know, and he's like, well, have you talked to her? I'm like, well, no, I haven't talked to her. No, I haven't talked to her. So, same thing. I got to pray and meditate, ask for direction. I get, this happens only a week or so, patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. Same thing. I pray for it. I get it. No problem. I'm a man of God. And by the way, I'm telling all the guys that I sponsor what great work I've done here, that I've done. This goes on for a few more years. Several years ago, it's Monday night. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. I'm getting ready to go to the meeting, and I realized that morning I went out the front door instead of the side door, which I never, ever, ever do. So I didn't get the trash and recycling. So I feel kind of bad. Part of me says it's about time she, because it's my job. You know, I'm a man of God. I've got it, no problem. So I wait. I'm having dinner with the wife and the girls, and the dog is there, and I wait for the ride. I said, Lynn, you know, you probably noticed that I didn't get the trash recycling this morning. I went out the front door instead of the side door. I apologize. I know that's my job. She looks at me. She goes, what? Okay, pause when agitated, right? So I slow it down. I say, you know, baby, the trash and recycling, and you know, and the dog poop. It was on the stoop. It's normally my job. I've only been doing it for over a decade, and I forgot to do it this morning. She goes, "What are you talking about?" So now my head's like a freaking rotisserie, right? You know, and I'm just, okay, calm down, pause when agitated. So I speak really slowly to her, right? And I explain it one more time. And she looks at me with that incredulous look that I've seen so many times in my wife's eyes. And she says, "Steve, you know that it's dark out there at night. We've got critters out there. We've got possums. We've got raccoons. We've got skunks. I mean, there've been coyotes that have been coming down from Palos Verdes. They've been taking small dogs and cats. And, you know, I don't like to go out there at night because it's creepy. And by the way, there are spiders and stuff out there. It's just nasty. So I leave it on the stoop. You know, I figure I'll get it in the morning, or the girls will get it, or you'll get it. But, you know, I don't leave it there for you." Newsflash. You know, I come to the realization that I've had this resentment that has absolutely no basis whatsoever in fact for over a decade. So I'm really spiritual. I look right at my wife and I go, "I love you, babe. I got to go." You know, because I'm not talking to her about it. I go to the meeting. I tell the guys that I sponsor my, and then they all, my sponsor, you know, guys, they all want to take me around to the new guy. Say, "Look, listen, this guy's got 17 years of sobriety. Listen to what he just did." Because we're a constant source of amusement. You know, we really are. You know, and my sponsor, you know, I remember he looked at me and he laughed. And he said, "Lamb, that's why they call it a delusion." And I remember that he told me a long time ago that people in Alcoholics Anonymous will get up to the podium and they'll talk about denial. And it's not that we don't suffer from denial, but denial is not a big book term. It's not a 12 and 12 term. It's a treatment center, you know, rehab type term. And it's not that we don't suffer from denial. Denial means I know the truth. I don't like the truth. I'm trying to convince you of the lie. But I know the truth. And you won't find it in the big book, except when you get to the fourth edition, there's a new story called Crossing the River of Denial. But in the basic text, it's not in there. It's not in the 12 and 12. But delusion and illusion, they're in there all over the place. A delusion is different. A delusion is, I didn't get the memo. You all know it's not true. I believe it's real. Real or imagined. This is imagined. And that's way more dangerous than denial, because I don't know what I don't know, and you all know what's real. And I'm operating on the false. Now, he did tell me there's good news and bad news. I said, "Well, what's the bad news?" He said, "Well, the bad news is it never ends. It never goes away. I don't care how long you've been sober." I'm like, "Oh, great. What's the good news?" He said, "Well, the good news is it's Alcoholics Anonymous. It means that there's always something to do, and there's always somebody to do it with." And that's one of the big deals. And that's why the amends are so important and forgiveness is important. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity said, "It is made perfectly clear that if we do not forgive, we shall not be forgiven. There are no two ways about it. What are we to do?" What are we to do? You know, God is either everything or he's nothing. What are we to do? We either turn to him, her, or it, whatever we want to refer to that higher power as, or we don't. And we're stuck in self-reliance, and we know where that gets us. That gets us fear. And what does the book tell us when we do that? Turn to him. So it doesn't matter what the question is, the solution is always the same. It's always the same. Now, one of the things that I want you to try to keep in mind here is one of the ways that AA has focused what's called the prayer of St. Francis. Now, the interesting thing about the prayer of St. Francis is historically it's pretty clear that Francis never wrote the prayer. You know, probably one of his followers wrote it. It first appears in a magazine called La Clochette in France in 1912, centuries after Francis died. But the prayer of St. Francis says, "Lord, make me an instrument of your peace." Our version in chapter 11, page 99 of the 12 and 12 says, "Lord, make me a channel of thy peace." Think about that. We've been talking about a channel. I can wield an instrument. I can hit you over the head with an instrument. I can't wield a channel. I have to clear a channel. I have to let whatever God is flow through me. And in the 11th step prayer, it says, "It is by forgiving that one is forgiven." And it concludes by saying, "It is dying that one awakens to eternal life." And that dying is a reference to dying to self. When Mother Teresa delivered address to the United Nations in 1985, and she's pretty much an uber Catholic, she kind of went with the AA version of the prayer of St. Francis. She said, "Lord, make me a channel of thy peace." She didn't say instrument. She said, "For it is by forgetting self that one finds." It is by forgetting self that one finds. And she talks about being one who can love rather than being loved, and it is through forgiveness that one is forgiven. So that, you know, basically gets us to the amends process. Or at step 9, we've talked about forgiveness. That's the ultimate remedy for an amends. So we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Now, this is not a novel concept. Again, you know, in the Bible, the gospel according to Matthew says, before you go to God, before you lay your gifts on the altar, first be reconciled to your brother. It seems rather drastic. But this is the second half of cleaning that dirty water glass that we talked about in the last session, so that you have the potable water. But consider this, June 10th, 1935, AA's birthday. Everybody knows that, right? Well, it's not Bob's birthday. It's not his AA birthday. It's not Bill's. Bill got sober in December of 1934. Dr. Bob initially got sober with Bill a little after Mother's Day of 1935. And then he had about 3 weeks. He brought Bill home with him to his house with Ann, his wife. And, you know, he was basically trying to work the program as best he knew it. Now, they didn't have the 12 steps then. They had certain principles in the Oxford group, and we had talked about them earlier. But they certainly included restitution, or what we now refer to as amends. But Dr. Bob, you know, he had a practice. You know, he was a proctologist. He was an anal surgeon. You know, he did rectal surgery and stuff like that. And he thought, you know, if people knew that I'm an alcoholic, like nobody knows we're an alcoholic, right? But if people knew that, that would somehow impact my practice. So I don't want to make restitution. I don't want to make amends. So he didn't. And he went about 3 weeks, and then he had to go to an American Medical Association convention, and he got on a train. He went to the convention. And he came back about three days later or so, and he's just stinking drunk as a skunk. And, you know, Bill's like, oh, my God. So they take him in, and now Dr. Bob's got to do surgery the next morning. So they give him a hooker of beer, which is a small amount of beer, and a goofball, which, by the way, is a barbiturate, okay? So he gets his, you know, to calm his nerves, because he's going to do anal surgery. I mean, this is kind of delicate stuff, right? And they send Dr. Bob off to do surgery. He's supposed to be back around 11 or 12. It's a morning surgery. He leaves, and 11 or 12, Bill and Bob's wife, Ann Smith, are waiting. He's not there. So they start pacing back and forth. They're worried. You know, there's no cell phones in. They can't call him. 1 o'clock, he doesn't show up. They're worried. 2 o'clock, doesn't show up. They're really worried. 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, doesn't show up. 5 o'clock, finally, he shows up. And he comes in the door, and Bill and Ann are like, where you been? You know, surgery was over in the morning. He goes, well, I went all around town, and I made amends. I made restitution. Now, Dr. Bob stayed sober ever since then. Is that a coincidence? I don't think so. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of times we talk about they balked. You know, somebody balks at the steps. And a lot of times people will make that reference in relation to 4 and 5. But think about what a balk is. A balk is a baseball maneuver where the pitcher makes a motion towards home plate as if he's going to throw a pitch and then changes his mind at some point in time after he's broken the plane, which is illegal, and he moves towards first, second, or third. That's a balk. And that allows anybody on base to take a base, because you can't do that. I've been doing this for a while. I've never really had anybody balk at a 4-step. Balk means you start and then you stop. A lot of times they tell me they're writing. I ask to look at the notebook. There's not squat in the notebook. They're not doing anything. People usually don't get halfway through and stop. I have never, ever, ever, ever had anybody in a 5-step balk in the middle of a 5-step. Say, that's enough. Not going to talk anymore. I'm done. Never had that happen. But in a 9-step, many times. I balked. I didn't want to make amends to my father. You know, it was a huge deal once I did it, but I didn't want to do it. I see that happen in the ninth step over and over and over again. So a couple things about amends, and then we're going to have a couple of your fellows give some personal amends stories. And by the way, just for the guys that come up and do the personal amends stories, I've been told by Rick that it's important to hold the microphone pretty close to your mouth so that they can hear this on the recording. I remember when I was new, I took a look at who I needed to make amends at and with, and I decided that, you know, I should really make amends to my ex-girlfriend, right? And I was having problems with my wife, and my sponsor suggested that I start with my wife, number one, and that number two, when I make amends to my ex-girlfriend, that I do it with my pants on, which I thought was a little rude, you know? But I, you know, later examined what my point was, and I didn't have proper motivation, let's say that. I mean, because what happens is when you're going to make an amends, what I succumbed to was I wanted to make amends to get an intended result. She'd forgive me, I'd do this, I'd do that, you know, whatever. That's not what the amends are about. The amends are about getting out of self and into God. They're about repairing the damage, reparation, repayment. They're about the other person. They're not about me. A lot of times with an amends story, you have a good result, but not always. Sometimes, as the book says, you know, they throw you out of the office. They throw you out of the window. That happens. You know, but I was taught no one amends per customer, no mumbled apology, and the importance of demonstration, particularly this ongoing amends. Some people call it a living amends, but whatever you want to call it, you have to act right. It's not just important that I repair the damage, but that I change my behavior so that I don't commit the same offense over and over and over again. Now, I got to tell you, one of the first times that I really felt, you know, that this was working for me was when I had to make amends to my wife. Now, there's all kinds of stuff in there that talks about the big book. You know, don't be specific. You know, if she asks, don't tell her. What should we do? And I'm freaking out about what if she asks me any of these details. And Michael said, look, just take it one thing at a time. It's very important that you just make amends. You acknowledge that you are a bad husband. Don't talk about specifics. Then let her talk. See what happens. So I speak for a living. That's what I do. But I was just nervous as a, you know, I was like a whore in church. I was really nervous. And I take my wife for a walk and I'm talking to her and I say, you know, Lynn, I need to talk to you and I really need to acknowledge my bad behavior. I want to make amends. And I mumbled a few things and she stopped me and she looked at me and she grabbed me by the hands and she said, look, I know what you're doing. I know you're an AA and you just need to keep doing what you're doing and please don't tell me any details. And I remember thinking, apparently there is a God. Apparently there is a God, you know, because this was a huge relief, you know. And I talked about my daughter, Ashley, but I got to tell you, some don't go so well. I needed to make amends to my brother, Tom. You know, I wasn't a good brother to my brother. My brother, when he was 15 or 16, he was just this great athlete. And I was 3 years younger than him, and I would go to these high school parties that he was at, and, you know, I would just get the overflow women. It was just unbelievable. I mean, 13, 14 years old, and he was just a god. And then, and this is, I'm not trying to be negative, but he found Jesus, like, in a real big way, okay? Changed his ways. He was a fantastic guitarist. He's 16, 17 years old. He's playing down on the strip, you know, when they have musicians that can't show up because he's that good. You know, he gave away all his guitars. He gave away about $30,000 for the guitars that my parents had given him. And he met his wife, and apparently God told him to get married to her. We thought it was ridiculous. That happened after 2 days. They've been married for 40-something years. What do I know, right? But he kind of deserted me on my hedonistic quest for, you know, women and alcohol and drugs, right? And now, you know, he's found God, and I'm, you know, this heathen guy, and, you know, he goes off and gets married, and I wind up, you know, I go to college, but I join the army. I'm a Green Beret. I'm an alcoholic. I'm the incubus. You know, I'm the devil's disciple from his point of view. So I got to make amends to him. And I go to make amends to my brother, and it doesn't go the way I think it's going to go. You know, he's very aloof. He's happy that I'm sober. Doesn't want to talk about Dot. Doesn't want to talk about any specifics. You know, I talk to him periodically throughout the year, but it's like, hey, the weather's good in Minnesota or Minneapolis or whatever, and, you know, it's sunny in California. You know, it's the shallowest conversation you could ever have. You know, when my stepfather died, I was the executive. I mean, it was a very businesslike conversation. And that really bothered me because I wanted my brother back. I was more concerned about what I would get than about his reaction. And I remember talking to Scott Redman about this, and he told me that his brother Mitchell hated him so much that he would never even talk to him. And he said, at least your brother talks to him. And have you ever considered the possibility, given your background compared to his background, that contact with you and your prior way of life and the way he perceives you, real or imagined, is more injurious to him than having that relationship? And I got quiet, and that was true. And the way I make amends to my brother, I'd like to have that kind of relationship, but I don't. I think that this is what he wants. I have to accept that. You know, I talked about insurance fraud. I was 3-4 years sober, listening to a guy's fifth step, and he told me that he'd committed insurance fraud. And I immediately went, God, I'd forgotten. Because, you know, when I'd come out, I was a second lieutenant in the Army, came out to see my girlfriend in California, and apparently I sideswiped a couple cars. I parked my car, and I reported to the insurance company, USAA, that my car had been sideswiped. And I'd been sideswiped on both sides. I don't know how you can do that on the street, but they paid for it, and they fixed it, and I didn't think anything about it. And I went to Korea. I served in Korea. You know, I served, 13 and a half years in the Army. I got out. Three years later, I get sober. I write my first inventory. That doesn't come up. I don't even remember it. Then this guy talks about insurance fraud. I'm like, God, I did that. So I write it out. I got to make amends. I call USAA. First guy can't help me. He says, I got to get a manager. I get a manager on the phone. The manager goes, wait a minute. You understand, first of all, that we canceled your insurance once you got that DUI. I said, yeah, I know, but I need to make amends. And I started explaining it to him. He goes, okay, so let me get this straight. You want us to open a file and go through all this paperwork for a few $1,000 just so you can feel better. I'm like, well, yeah, pretty much. And he goes, well, that's not how it's going to work. And he hung up on me. And I remembered that my sponsor had said one amends per customer. So I'm like, cool, no problem. I figured it was $4,000 or $5,000. I told Michael, I said, hey, I did it. He hung up on me, one amends per customer, right? He goes, that's absolutely right. That's good. That's good work. He goes, but you know. Now, when your sponsor goes, but you know, you're about to get hosed. He goes, but you know, we talked about this. That's not really your money, is it? I said, well, no, I've been holding it for a long time. It kind of felt like mine, but I get it. It's not mine. He goes, well, you know, if you really want to be spiritual, you might want to consider giving that money to charity because it's really not your money. I don't know that I want to be that spiritual, right? But I pray and meditate. I come back. I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it to charity. He goes, but you know. And I'm like, oh, what? What? He goes, you know, since it's really not your money, then you really shouldn't take a tax deduction because it's really not your money. Now, I think we're pushing the envelope of spirituality now, right? And I pray and meditate, but I want to stay sober. So I'm like, okay, so I do that. I give the money away, and I'm not going to take a tax deduction. I tell Michael. He goes, that's good. But you know, and I'm like, oh, my God. What, you know, what's next? He says, if you really want to be spiritual, you probably shouldn't talk about it for 2 or 3 years. Probably should just let that set for a couple years. Now, I'm an instant gratification guy. If I'm going to go through all the pain, I want to get credit for it. You know, I want to tell people. And he tells me, no, I can't do it. And I did that. And there's a tremendous amount of growth in that. And there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in the people that have gone through this process and made amends. And like I said, sometimes they go well, sometimes they don't go well. What I want to do now is I want to call up a few guys. They're going to share hopefully for about 3 to 5 minutes each on a personal amends story. The reason why I think this is so important is because amends are critical. They're absolutely critical. And one of the things that we strive for in Alcoholics Anonymous is the experience, the sharing of the demonstration, and then the identification. And this is something that in my experience helps the new guy to realize that, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what we're doing. So the first person that I'm going to ask to come up is Jackson. Come on, Jackson. Now, be nice to Jackson. He says he doesn't like to talk, but his sponsor made him do this. The mic is right here, sir.
Oh,
Right there.
Jackson, alcoholic.
Jackson.
So I guess it was about 3 years ago. This was the last amends on the past 12 steps that I worked. And this was a friend of mine from Philadelphia. I had moved to Philadelphia years ago when I was an architect. And I met this woman. We started the first, you know, gay and lesbian architecture social group in Philadelphia, which is basically happy hour. And we became really good friends. I got to know her family. I spent holidays with her family, Thanksgiving and stuff. And then I got into grad school and I moved to New York. And that's when my addiction kind of started to hit. And it was Christmas, and I was stuck in New York. I didn't have money to go home, and I was having to work on people's films in school. And she was like, look, why don't I come up? I miss you. I'll come up. We can do some Christmas shopping together. I said, great. So the day she comes up, the night before, I had smoked crack and crystal for the first time all night long. And literally, I was walking down the sidewalk one way. She was walking down the sidewalk this way. And we had to go to the ER. My heart rate was 160. And she was stuck out in the waiting area for the whole day while I was in the ER because she wasn't family. And the doctor came in and said she left. And so, you know, our friendship kind of fizzled over the years. And then I lost her phone number because I lost so many phones. And then I moved to L.A., and I kept searching for her on Facebook, and she wasn't on there. And then finally, I found her, and I friended her, and it took her 3 months to accept my friendship. And so I started noticing that she was liking my posts and probably could figure out that I was sober and had a better life. And so my sponsor said, go ahead and send her a message on Facebook. So I messaged her, and I said, hey, listen, I would like to talk to you on the phone. It's really important. And she replied, am I on your amends list? I think this might be what you're going to call me about. And I was just like, how did she know this? And so I called. And, you know, I just had this expectation that that I was going to apologize, I was going to be forgiven, you know, and it would reconnect things. And I had no idea what was about to happen. So I called and I said, you know, the wrong that I think that I did was what happened the day at the ER. And I said, did I miss anything? And she was like, really? I said, okay. And she said, how about that time that I came up and you were in the hospital for 10 days with 104 fever, you had hepatitis, your mom was there, and I walked her down the Hudson River for 3 hours while she sobbed thinking you were gonna die. How about that time when I came up months later, and you were off a run, I could tell you'd been working on a film shoot or something, and she said, my friend was gone. It was too painful for me to stay in this friendship because I was in so much pain seeing you go through this. And, you know, I was trying to keep it together, and when she said that, I just lost it. And I said, what can I do to make this right? And she said, the call's enough. I said, no, what can I do to make this right? And she said, you know, I haven't seen a movie in 13 years. I thought the film industry took you away from me, so I have not watched a movie. And I was like, you never tell a film director that you stopped watching movies. And so it occurred to me that what the amends was, and so I put the care package together that had, can I get some water? Okay, thank you.
Those aren't all mine.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that.
I'm a heavy drinker, but not that much.
That's better. And so I put a care package together that had popcorn containers and popcorn and things that you would have in a movie. And I made a list of 100 movies that inspired me to be a film director. And I bought her a year-long membership to Netflix. So every Saturday after that, she would text me and she'd be like, oh my God, I just saw Umberto D. I never would have seen that. And we talk about what it meant. And every Saturday she would watch one of the movies. And we started to rebuild the friendship. And what I didn't know until we started doing this was how life was really small and painful. She had moved in with her parents. She wasn't in love. Her career was never what she wanted it to be. I mean, she was not where she wanted to be with it. And I could tell, and she was just really dark. And the more we started to talk and rebuild, I started to notice she moved out of her mom's house. She started dating a woman. She got engaged. And then she found out that she had nose cancer. She'd have her entire nose removed and had to go through 6 months of radiation and chemo. And halfway through the process, her girlfriend, her fiance, called me. She said, look, you're her best friend, and she really needs you. Can you come up for the last week of her treatment? And she said, I'll pay for the ticket. I said, sure. And I showed up and, you know, took her to her appointments, and she was really angry, and her fiance was, you know, pulled me aside and said, you know, I don't think I can keep this relationship going. It's just, and I noticed that Sarah was really angry at the people that were right there helping her the most, but the anger was misdirected. I had done therapy around family of origin stuff. So I sat her down and I said, you know, I think maybe what you need to do here is to do some work around your family with your therapist. And she said, really? And I said, yeah. And she was like, but I'm doing cancer treatment and stuff. And I said, I had full-blown AIDS when I started doing the work. So you can do it, and it can heal you. So she started doing therapy, and it's really transformed her. And so I was in the shower a couple of months after that, and I was thinking about it. And I remember her saying that the wrong was that her best friend had left her. And I still get emotional about this. And I showed up for her. I was there for her, and that there was a healing that happened. And I think more than healing for me is just seeing how her life has changed, and you know how she survived this incredibly horrific experience with having her nose removed. And she's getting married next January, and she, in Maui, so I'm going to a wedding in Maui, and you know, she's, the friendship has blossomed in a way I couldn't have imagined. So that's it. Thank you.
Beautiful story. Thanks. Ahmad.
My name is Ahmad. I'm an alcoholic.
Ahmad.
I had to make amends to my cousin. And when I went to make amends to him, I told him what I had done, and he couldn't remember it. So I tried to really jog his memory. I'm like, look, I did this, and then you did that, and you said this, and this is what I did. And he couldn't remember it. And I did everything I could to try to remind him of what I did or how I had harmed him, and he just couldn't remember it. And at that moment, I thought, I carried the guilt and the shame for 13 years of something he can't, of what I did to him for something he can't even recollect. He can't even remember. And so I said, okay, well, this is what I remember. Is there anything that I, this is what I know, that, is there anything that I haven't told you that, that I'm not aware of? And he said, you know, there was this one time, and then he shared something with me that I had done that, that harmed him, and we talked about it. I couldn't really clearly remember, but I recollected, and we talked. And at the end of the talk, what he did was he took a big, deep breath, and he just, like a sigh of relief, he just did. And it was at that moment when I realized the amends isn't for me, because now he's relieved of something that happened 13, 14 years ago. He has finally had closure for this thing that he carried. And that was one of the almost first amends that I made that really kind of kept me going on. Thank you.
Great story. Great story. Daniel.
Hey, Daniel, alcoholic.
Daniel.
And first of all, I want to thank you, Stephen Lamb, for this. I mean, it's crazy. 11 years ago was my first retreat, and it was, I had 4 months of sobriety, and Sandy Beach led it. So it's, so, whoa. Anyway, you know, my, the amends that, that really hit me the most was shortly after I barely graduated from college in New York, I was renting a room from next to a friend of mine who had actually gotten sober. It was a small room, and you know, I was doing what a young alcoholic who thinks he's doing great things but is really just not doing much in New York at that time. And And so I was renting this room, and it was like $360 a month or something like this, like really still cheap. And so, I had these resentments about all these, you know, I was somehow this poor kid who wasn't really going to get a break. Whatever was going on in my head. So I was renting this room for $360 a month, and so the last three and a half months I didn't pay the rent before I went to rehab that actually at this time didn't even work. There was another about 9 or 10 years before I came sober, and I remember like even seeing a note from my father about this to this man Philip Chen, who was the one who was renting this room to me, about, you know, someday my son will like get the responsibility to like pay the bills and everything, right? And so it was like looming over my head that this, you know, $1,000, you know, thing would be something I would have to pay when I, you know, got sober. And so I really didn't think much of it. And so a couple years in, I went back to New York to visit my friend and to make my amends to Philip Chen. And so I asked my friend to talk to him and I talked to him and I paid him what I owed him, and I started, and, you know, and I was just really sorry for how I just ran off without paying and everything. And it was so funny because I had this, you know, and it was starting to fade away at this point, but this sort of image of these rich economics professor people, which is what he was. He was actually like an economics professor, people who were, you know, and you know, after I paid and we started talking, he was so excited to see me. That was the first thing. I was like this guy who I jilted on money, and then I would, you know, for years. And we sat down and we talked, and he started joking with me about how the fact at that point in his life, he was starting to try to do some sort of business sort of stuff. Part of things was real estate and other things in New York, and how he was having issues with real estate and also as tenants like myself, as you can see. And there was this, having this great conversation with him, someone who I'd kind of feared in the back of my head, and how who someone who I had developed, you know, all these resentments that you're talking about the completely false views of the world itself, you know, blew up in just me simply giving back, you know, $965 that I owed for an apartment. And the power it had for me to just see that my perception of the world and manhood and responsibility and just growing up was how false it was. And it's funny how even that specific resentment I remember more than resentments that I made to my family. And it has had the effect later in life for making me have much more of an open, and making me able to, when that mind starts rolling, to make judgments about the world and how the world's treated me or something, I remember that resentment and how much just being straight and honest, paying your bills, and trying to be responsible and doing the best you can and being honest about it, how powerful. I mean, it's just this most simple and basic thing that I get out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to thank all of you so much for that.
So. All right, Radcliffe, last one. Let's do it. Let's get the old dog up here. Come on.
The old what? Radcliffe, alcoholic.
Radcliffe.
We make amends where possible. And my mother didn't know how to be a mother. I hated her. She wouldn't come to the hospital after I was born. I guess my hate started at that time, for 6 months. And then when she did get me, she gave me away. And then she would re-enter my life, and I didn't know who this woman was. I just saw her as a hermit, as a terrible person. When I was with her, she was yelling, complaining, criticizing, condemning. If it wasn't me, one time she hit me, and I thought, she doesn't even know me. I don't even know her. Who's this woman? And so she put me in this institution for several years. And what happened is in the steps, in my 12th year of sobriety, this was eating me alive. Because like Steve was saying, I was doing everything I could do. I was looking spiritual. I was talking spiritual. But this thing was eating me. And it says, where possible. So I called her up, and she didn't want to hear my amends. And so what happened was I wrote her a letter. And then she calls me up and said, I didn't understand what you said. And I thought, oh, my God, I hate talking to this person. And then what happened was, talking about divine intervention, what happened was she got brain cancer. And she was in bed 3,000 miles away, and her sister called me and said, she's in bed. She has brain cancer. And here's a woman I thought had nothing going for her. So I flew out to Detroit, where she was. I had grown up in poverty. And there she's in bed. First thing she says, she's still able to talk, how much she dislikes my wife. I thought how sad a woman who's 76 years old, about to die, and complaining about my wife, who's, this, as you know, anyone that knows her, she's the sweetest person. And so I was there. I tried to make an amends to her for what? I was using her as my excuse for my failure in life. And I was believing all my third column beliefs about how she affected my self-esteem and my pride and my security and how she ruined my life. And then what happened was she died. And I'm at the funeral home. And she's laid out in the casket. And it was as if all these people started coming in this door and sitting in the funeral home. And each one would get up and say, this person helped me with my career. This person helped me become successful in business. This person helped me to be a better father, a better mother. They were talking about my mother. What she would do for 25 years, I had no idea. She would sit in a cafe having coffee, smelling the secondhand smoke is why they said she died. But the thing is, she was helping with their kids. She was sending them cards and presents with her little bit of disability money. She was doing everything she could to be a force in the community for good. I had no idea. Totally blew my mind. All these people getting up praising my mother. I couldn't even speak because I'm still stuck with all my hate in the funeral home looking at her body. And all of a sudden, it was as if forgiveness came. And it was like a divine intervention. Do you mean, Radcliffe, all of your thoughts about your mother are false? Yeah. It was my reaction to her. I never let her in. She was trying to make amends. I couldn't receive it because of my hate. And the program prepared me for that. In the 12th step, in the 12 and 12, it says, it's like the steps get us prepared to receive God, to receive the divine intervention. And that happened in about 1999, when that came down. All these years later, it changed my program, forgiveness. I'm so easy now to let go of claims I have on people and demands I have on people. Forgiveness is so divine. I never thought I would understand forgiveness. And now it was that divine intervention, all these people getting up and praising my mother and me witnessing that and knowing that my beliefs were false. Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, that was beautiful. I really appreciate that. And, you know, it's funny because when I got the names, I thought, well, maybe I should organize them and do them in a particular order. And then I thought, wait a minute, you're going to talk about not playing God. Why don't you just let it happen the way it's happened? And that really happened in a really profound way, and I really appreciate that. So it's time for lunch, the big break. Now, if you've got any questions, put them in the basket there. You know, if you want to ask a question, you know, from out there, that's fine. I'll repeat it for the tape, but I think Rick would prefer it if you write it down for posterity. So thank you very much. I thought that was a great session. I don't think it could have gone. Wait a minute. Just That's a person who wants lunch, okay? But frankly, thank God I didn't plan it that way towards the end, because I don't think it could have gone better. Thank you, gentlemen. 1 o'clock. We're back here at 1 o'clock. When Quasimodo rings the bell, we're back here at 1 o'clock.